Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very courageous and special guest. When you hear what she did and she wrote a book about it, you are going to be inspired and want to read her book. So welcome, Heidi Byerly.
Yay. Thanks for having me, Hillary.
Yeah. So I was reading Heidi's book and we're not going to give it away. So we have to be careful what we say, but I'll tell you what, I couldn't put it down. I had to figure out where what happened. So anyway, do you want to just hold up your book so that they can go order it while they're listening to the interview? Okay, it's called Heidi Across America by Heidi Byerly, and you can get it many places. You can get it Amazon. You can get it where else? Bookstores?
Yes.
All over?
Yeah, anywhere books are sold.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So you can do that. Now we're going to talk about Heidi. So Heidi, I forgot to say, she's an author, an artist, and a slow traveler. So do you want to explain what slow traveler is before we keep going?
Sure.
People are watching. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. So slow travel builds on some of the philosophies of these other slow movements, like the slow food movement. And the idea with slow travel, it could be a lot of different things, right? So I have three main things that slow travel could be, and slow travel could be one of them. It could be two of them. It could be all three of them together. So slow travel can be this idea of micro travel or mindfulness, where you're paying attention to where you are in a particular place. It could be as things, right? So I have three main things that slow travel could be, and slow travel could be one of them. It could be two of them. It could be all three of them together. So slow travel can be this idea of micro travel or mindfulness, where you're paying attention to where you are in a particular place. It could be as things, right? So I have three main things that slow travel could be, and slow travel could be one of
food.
The slow food movement is the antidote to the fast food movement, where the idea is you're having a wholesome meal cooked, you know, locally. You take the time to prepare the meal and sit and eat and digest and have conversation and other things. That's the idea that, you know, you're not just like grabbing a bite, but you're having a whole experience around the food that you're putting in your body.
That is so, you know, I've never heard of this, but I mean, I've heard of like being mindful instead of just shoving something in your mouth and not paying attention to it and actually sitting, paying attention, but that's really cool. Okay. Are there other slow movements like involving other things?
I feel like there's another one that it's not coming to me immediately, but so.
And did you make up the slow travel?
I'm not sure that I've made it up per se, but I feel like I've been building on it. So this idea of three things we've talked about, one, is not something that I've seen anywhere else. It's something that I've kind of absorbed from reading other things and also practicing it, articulating what the things are. So the second one is the idea of the journey is the destination, that speed is not what we're after. And what can often happen when you're traveling using climate-friendly modes of travel, like walking or biking or paddling or skiing or something like that, you're not necessarily headed to a destination. Maybe you are, but the destination is kind of secondary to the experience that you have while you're getting there. And so like that could be a number of things, right? It doesn't necessarily have to be active modes, like riding the train or using transit or ferries or other things like that are also constitute slow travel. Just the idea that you're moving more slowly than you might be if you were getting in a car, driving on the interstate, or hopping in a plane and not really having an experience of the landscape around you.
You know, it's so interesting because, you know, when something is right there, like, so yesterday I was driving home with my mother. I was just telling Heidi, who's 94, has dementia. We also had my daughter in the car, which was very helpful. And I was upset because we were leaving late. And I wanted to get home. My computer had broken. I knew I needed to buy a new one. And so there were moments where I just felt like so frustrated. And then there were moments where I could be where we were and laugh. We played this game with the cars and we were counting, you know, each color and which is that. And we called them big man trucks and little man trucks, you know, and so we started having fun. So there were moments, I think, when I was slow traveling. And then there were moments where I was back in like the rat race of, I got to get home. I got to get this computer. I don't know how I'm going to, you know, like the crazy. And I could feel the difference. Mm-hmm. It was like radically different. One, I felt like I was going to kill someone. And the other, I was just enjoying my life. And I'm thinking that's what you mean by the slow travel is, you know, and like there were moments when I said, okay, I'm going to get home an hour later. Who cares? Like no one's going to die. Nothing's going to happen. I can reschedule what I, you know, I was almost going to reschedule this because of the computer. And it was like, you know, it's not the end of the world, but it felt like it. And I think when it feels like it, that's an indicator that it's not slow travel, right?
Yes. And you're also bringing up the third thing, which is live somewhere else, which is a loose term for, so let's just say you do get in your car, right? You want to go see your mother with dementia, right? So the travel is not the important part. The important part is spending time in this destination. And, you know, this also could be like airplanes are welcome too. Like you don't want to spend all your time getting to somewhere and maybe you can't even get there using something other than a plane. So you hop on a plane and you go somewhere, but then the idea is that you spend time in that place and it's minimal plans, loose plans, or no plans. And the idea is that you're really sinking into the culture of where you are. You're talking to the locals, you're eating the local food, a la the slow food movement. You know, you're whatever the local culture is around you. Maybe this is where you get out and you just kind of wander around wherever it is exploring. So that's the third idea. So in your example, yes, it is more the slow travel of I'm getting somewhere because where I want to be, this is where the destination is more important, right? So mm-hmm. I want to be at a particular destination and have the experience in this place. And yeah, so you spend time with your mother and, you know, just being in the culture, being with the people there, definitely slow travel. Mm. And like gardening could be slow travel too. Right. Especially because you're outside and you're paying attention to all the different things. You're not necessarily going anywhere, but you're really living somewhere else for a while. You're really spending the time with the community of organisms, you know, for lack of a better word, that are all around you.
Well, you know, it's funny. I asked my brother-in-law because he has this beautiful garden and he was out there, you know, doing all his thing because they were having company. My sister had this big dinner, 46 people. And so they were getting all ready for 2 days while we were there. And I said, do you enjoy it? And his answer was, I enjoy the result. So I don't know how that fits in. You know, and there were times when I was there, you know, it wasn't my home, you know, so they were doing their thing where I almost like couldn't be where I was because I felt like, you know what I mean? Like there was something, I was just, I was uncomfortable with something, with obviously with myself because there was no one else around. And it was interesting to try to, I think what I was missing was peace within myself to just be where I was because I felt like I should be somewhere else or I should be doing something, you know? And so I think the only thing that I can learn from it is just being aware mm-hmm. that, okay, I don't feel peace. How can I return to peace? Mm-hmm. Because I think probably if, you know, let's say you were at a place and you were with the locals and you thought, oh my God, I got to get moving. Or remember when you had your deadline and then all of a sudden you're stressed mm-hmm. and you're not just going along with the ride or going on the hills or riding up the hills. You're thinking about where you should be and how long it's going to take, right? Something like that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the values of travel generally, slow travel also, is you can't actually ever escape who you are. But by taking yourself out of your familiar and normal environment, you open yourself to the possibility of, you know, being outside your comfort zone, of having an encounter with yourself, which is actually what happened to me in this story. So it doesn't have to be a grand epic adventure, but I do think part of why people consider travel as transformational as they do is because we do put ourselves in these positions where we actually learn something about ourselves by encountering things that, you know, we're unfamiliar with and seeing how we respond and react.
Yes. Good point. And so it's okay to have that discomfort. It's not wrong. It's just a place to grow. Beautiful. Thank you. All right. I'll send me the invoice for this psychiatry visit and then we'll go for it. All right, great. All right. So let's take the audience back a little bit because we've been talking about the slow movement. Let's just talk about this, how the setup worked for your book, but we'll call it your trip because she did go on a trip, but you'll hear about it later, or you could tell them whenever you want, how it happened that you went on this. All right. I'll just say long bike trip. Okay. Go ahead.
All right. So yes, I rode my bicycle across the country. It was in the summer of 2010. I was living in Eugene, Oregon at the time, attending classes at the University of Oregon. And I pedaled to Washington, D.C. And I went to school because of the recession. I was already feeling kind of down and lonely and stuck in my life. And things didn't feel like they were going very well. And I was underemployed. And I kept seeing these job postings for the kinds of jobs that were really attractive to me. But I didn't have a relevant degree. And so,
and how old were you, Heidi? Just so we can place you.
In 2008, I was 33. So okay. I went on this journey when I was 35.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So you had, and before that you had gone to school and just had jobs you didn't love
Well, how do I describe this? So yes, I mean, I had an undergraduate and graduate degree already in English. And people always told me, oh, you can do anything with that, which they really kind of meant teach. But, you know, it was like, okay, well, so I had this education in English, and I did have a real job while I was finishing up my graduate degree in English. I was working at an art museum as a proposal writer, which I really enjoyed. I had no idea a job like that existed. And I thought, how come nobody told me about this? It was really fun. And, you know, I love art and I really enjoyed learning about the art and writing about it and asking for money. And I also was pretty young and wanted to go adventure. And so I left that job to go be a climbing bum, kind of. I worked at REI selling outdoor gear.
Wow.
I moved to Colorado. I did, you know, I did a lot of mountain climbing. I was really, really into peak bagging and ice climbing. And so rock climbing.
And was that after your graduate degree? So you yes. finished the degree and then you went to Colorado. Mm-hmm. Where did you start? Were you in Oregon to start?
Oh, well, I grew up in Wyoming. And I went to undergraduate school in upstate New York. And then I went to graduate school in Fort Worth, Texas. And so I went from Fort Worth to Colorado. And then from Colorado, I transferred my job with REI to Eugene, Oregon. So that's how I ended up in Eugene.
Wow. And where in upstate New York?
I went to Colgate University.
Colgate. Okay. Cool. You grew up in Wyoming, that way you went around. So you went from Wyoming to Colgate and then, to Texas. So you went around, you kind of did the whole country thing and then over or whatever, which way to Colorado and then back to Oregon. Okay, cool. Wow.
Yeah. So
covered a lot of territory, right?
Right. And, you know, it's a little hard to describe so that, you know, I had this professional job as a grant writer when I was in Texas, and then I shifted to retail sales. And I did some other jobs and contract work and actually wound up working under the table for a lot of my time. Part of it was like house sitting for friends and gardening for them. And I had a very kind of itinerant work life as I was trying to figure out what I was really interested in. And Eugene also wasn't really it didn't have a whole lot of opportunity for me in terms of job market being a smaller town. And,
how did you end up in Eugene?
I transferred my job.
Oh, right. Okay.
I mean, there were some other things about how I ended up there. I was a vegan at the time and I was looking for a place to live and they had all these, advertisements for rooms for, people who were vegan, which was not that normal really in Colorado. So I thought, oh, my people are here.
Yeah.
I had no idea what Eugene was like before I got there. I was like, oh, all right. Yeah. Interesting place. It's kind of, it's kind of a city of artists. And so anyway, I really loved my time in Eugene. And
but so you said you were underemployed.
Yeah.
It was a recession. You still have the REI job? Or you went back to school for something?
Yeah. So I was, I was always just kind of piecing it together. I was definitely looking for a change, like the hustle of trying to figure out, what's the next gardening job? What's the next house sitting job? I had a mortgage actually. And it was just like, it was so much work to just always have enough money on hand to pay the mortgage. And, sometimes there wasn't money for anything else really.
Yeah. You probably don't want to talk about it, but so when you got to Eugene, you actually bought a place, right?
Not immediately, but I did end up buying a place. My parents helped me buy a house. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So you liked it enough to do that, obviously.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, good.
Yeah.
And so what year did you get there?
I arrived in Eugene in 2002.
Oh, okay. Okay. Cool. So you were still trying to figure out the age. If you were 33 in 2008, so you were, that was 6 years before. You were still in your late 20s.
Yeah.
26. Oh, okay. So you're a baby. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. So you were just figuring it out. That's, my kids are like that.
For anybody who's into the astrology, this was like going back to school was kind of the result of my Saturn return. It wasn't the actual happening of my Saturn return. Like nothing was happening during my Saturn return, which was part of what was frustrating me so badly. I was like, why can't I get anything to happen?
Okay. And then you went back to school when you went, okay, question. Did you know you didn't want to be a teacher? Like, why did you get the graduate degree in English, or was that just the thing to do, you know? Or people said it was a good idea or something. And it's okay when we're in our 20s, but.
I think I so here's my I didn't know how to change my life necessarily when I was a young person. What I did know was that school was one avenue to do that. So when I graduated from high school, I wanted to get the heck out of town, and I used going to college as an opportunity to do that, which I wanted to see more of the world and experience different cultures and environments, and it was really the perfect thing for me to do what I did. And so when I had a gap year between graduating undergrad and going to grad school, and that was, I was like, well, I don't know what to do here. I don't want to stay in Wyoming. And so I applied to graduate school because that was how I knew
To
how to
do
get
it,
out of
yeah.
town.
Okay, makes sense. Yeah.
So,
So you went to Texas, okay.
yeah.
And
And then I
then.
learned some other ways of getting out of town at that point.
Okay, would you like to talk about them or no?
Well, I just, I met some other people who, were maybe not on the education track, who were having lives, and not to say that they were unstuck. They just had a different way of being in the world that was interesting to me. And I met somebody from Washington State, and I traveled to visit him. And he also had a connection to Portland, Oregon. And so I had gone traveling, and then I had also gotten into mountain climbing. I was into mountain climbing before I even went to college, but hadn't really done it on my own. And when I was in Texas, I started working at REI and met people interested in that kind of thing. And so I started to just really enjoy the fact that I had this freedom and liberty to go out and adventure and experience the world. And how my pursuit of climbing then was this avenue for me to see different parts of the country and different parts of the world. And
Wow, it's so cool. So, okay. So from Fort Worth to Colorado, that's where you worked for REI and you climbed, right? And then you went to Eugene and was a vegan and bought your house, and there you were.
yeah,
Okay.
so I originally started working at REI in Dallas, and I
Okay.
transferred my job in Dallas to Colorado, transferred
Okay.
that job in Colorado to Oregon.
Okay.
That was the through line. Most people showed up in Eugene. I often joke that I showed up in Eugene because my VW bus broke down, because that's how most people end up in
Yeah.
Eugene. But I actually had a job, which was never the way anybody showed up in Eugene with a job.
That's funny. So then, okay, so when you went back to school, I keep forgetting, what did you go back to study?
I went to study community and regional planning. So
Okay.
I was thinking of art therapy, and I was thinking, oh, I'll go to Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado. And then I thought, well, that's an expensive city. I don't have any money. Why would I maroon myself there? And so I looked at what programs were available at the University of Oregon. At the time, I also had gotten involved in my neighborhood association. I was a city planning commissioner, and I had also been working on a contract basis with some nonprofit arts organizations that were looking at arts as a way to revitalize the downtown area. And so there was this interest to me, the kind of intersection of art with planning. And I was finding these jobs that were for active transportation planners, bicycle pedestrian planners, and they all required a relevant degree, right? So English was not relevant, even though I feel like that is absolutely a relevant degree for a planning, planning type of position. But so I was like, I have a graduate degree, but I am not qualified for these jobs, even though I'm doing this work, basically. Mm-hmm. And I had considered landscape architecture, but that was a four-year program. Planning was two, and I didn't need to resubmit SATs or I don't know, whatever it was. It was like an easy thing. I was like, okay, what's the least amount of time I have to go back and, you know, what is kind of in my interest area?
Yeah.
What you know, what qualifies as a relevant degree for what I think I want to do?
So, okay. So then, so you went how long before your bike trip?
Well, so I started in the fall of 2009 back to school. And it was a very jarring experience for me. I had a social life, right? I had been in Eugene and encountered all these people and made all these friends. And when school started, it was like deadline, deadline, deadline. Got to read all this stuff, churn through it, write. And I was like, my friends, every once in a while I would hang out with them, but I was like, oh my gosh, this managing my social life on top of all this schoolwork is not working very well. I was like going to bed at 7 o'clock at night and getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to just try and, you know, get my work done in the way I could do it. It was very, so like my social life got cut off. I was having issues with my hip. I just like so much sitting. I was just like going in this downward spiral and I was like, oh my gosh, this was the wrong thing to do. Like the school thing isn't working. And all I wanted to do was ride my bike. I was like, I love riding my bike. I feel so happy when I'm out there just, you know, in nature and pedaling around and being in my skin. Like that would solve all my problems. And so in December, it was the very beginning of December, it was during final presentations. And I got this email from my mom that was an announcement about the Preserving the Historic Road Conference, which was in Washington, D.C. in September of 2010. So December 2009, September of 2010. And I have an uncle who lives in Washington, D.C. And so my mom's message was, hey, here's this conference. Let's go to this conference and hang out with the uncle and that'd be dandy. And I was like, yeah, I was actually interested in transportation and preservation, which was why she sent it. Mm-hmm. But I was like, that doesn't actually sound like something that would fill me up. You know, it's not like the thing that's calling for me to do. But then I was like, but it's in September. And I was like, oh, you know, the fall term starts at the end of September. I was like, spring is done in June. That's like, I don't know, could I ride to Washington, D.C. over the summer? And so I wrote this really flip response. You know, it was like this really quick calculation. I was like, I don't know if it's possible, but why not? So I was like, sure, I'll ride out there and meet you. And I sent the email and then I was like, wow, that's a great idea. I should do that. I had no aspirations.
Where was your mom? Where was your mom coming from?
She's also in Oregon.
Oh, okay.
So not in the same town, but nearby. Like
it was gonna fly. Yeah.
Yeah. So
okay, good.
So then I was like, okay, what a good idea. I gotta get myself a spot to speak at this conference, which I did. I gotta figure, you know, and like I'll make this my research project. I'll make it the basis of my research for my program. And you know, just
how did you get a spot to speak? You just said, hey, I want to speak. Like how did that happen?
You know, I'm creative and crafty.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, that's amazing. I'm impressed.
Well, I
want to know how you did it. Yeah.
The conference had a topic area on historic road tourism. And so part of how I ended up creating the project I did had to do with the conference. I was like, okay, so if this is my destination and there's an opportunity to talk about tourism on historic roads, like how do I make those connections? I'm going to be on a bike. And so then it was like, okay, it's about bike tourism. And at first I thought it was going to be kind of an environmental climate focus research project. But then I had people saying, you know, long distance bike travel isn't going to make a dent in carbon because not enough people can do that. So then I shifted my focus to the economics of it. Like, does it make economic sense for rural communities to support bicycle tourism? And rural communities and historic roads go together too. So this was one of the things that I was learning about transportation and preservation. So that's how I came up with the idea, was this idea that bicycle tourism could support rural economic development. So it wasn't necessarily about the bicyclist per se, but it was really more about small community development.
And not necessarily about the historic roads, or that fit in?
I mean, it's interesting how the historic roads fit in. Like, a lot of historic roads are scenic byways, and so bicycle touring routes tend to follow these low traffic scenic roads because it's a nice experience. When roads were originally built, they were built as scenic driving experiences. They weren't interested in just going as fast as they could. So when the interstate system came in, that really changed the scope of how people travel and how communities benefited or didn't benefit. And so off of the interstates on these slow traveled routes is the evidence of the past transportation system where these communities had, you know, facilities for travelers, like motels and hotels. And even before vehicles, the towns are spaced about 25 miles apart because that's as far as a horse can travel in one day. And so it was actually a really fascinating thing to experience. Like, this, you know, traveling in the rural countryside is really pretty comfortable as a cyclist. Like, there's hardly anybody on these roads. The towns are spaced at convenient intervals where I don't have to go too far without resources or services. And they travel through really beautiful countryside. So there's more about the rural roads too. I think there's really some great opportunities for bicycling to provide some kind of benefit for historic areas because there's less vibration, less road space needed to accommodate bicycles. So in historic communities, there's, inviting bicyclists in is actually one way to help a community protect its historic resources.
Interesting. This is so cool. All right. We'll hold that thought. Can you remember what you were going to say? Because we're going to go to our commercial break and then we're going to come back and hear the rest. This is so, some of that I missed while reading, but it really provides a great, anyway. Okay. All right. We'll come back. Okay.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say?
or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
And thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KokoriApp.com. If you would like to bring experiential, social-emotional learning to your schools, to your teams, to your businesses, go to KokoriApp.com. It's a fabulous product, and it really does. If you do their activities, you will feel connected, you will feel social, and you will start loving your life more. So that's KokoriApp.com. Go to the website and schedule a consultation. And as always, if you don't feel comfortable speaking up, if something's bothering you, you can't put your finger on it, but you want to have a non-judgmental ear, go to Hillary. You can email me at Hillary@gettingrealwithhillary.com. We can have a conversation and get you back into loving your life again, because it really does work. I use this technique all the time and it always helps me. So welcome back, Heidi Byerly. Is that, am I saying it right?
Yep.
Okay, good. All right. So, okay. So you decide all these different things, the historic roads. We have tourism, bike tourism. You're going to speak at the conference, right? Am I missing part of it? No, I can't even read my own notes. And the scenic roads and all that. But I never knew that about the way that people used to drive was the scenic routes. And then when they put in the highways, that's just for speed. It's so interesting, right? I just never thought about it because I probably don't go, I'm in the Northeast. I probably haven't really driven out there that much. So is that how you, so you had this thought before I give it away. You decided to do this. That's how you planned your trip to go through these historic places, right? And the scenic roads. Is that right?
Well, I'd like to think it was intentional like that, but I had more like this idea. Like I'm studying bicycle tourism and its benefit to rural communities. And I had an idea that there was also a connection. Because research that I did before I left is that there was a good roads movement established early turn of the century ish, 19th, early 20th century, I guess, to improve the quality of roads. And it was actually initiated by bicyclists because the bicyclists were out touring before the automobile became popular. Bicycles were wildly popular. And so
are you talking about the 1900s?
Yeah.
Like early 1900, like, wow. Okay. Yep. Wow. So bicycles, is that when they had the big ones, when you see the picture of the big wheel?
Right. They call them the ordinary or the penny farthing. So that was part of it. The bicycle evolved fairly quickly, over like a, I'm a little rusty on my dates, but like a 20-30 year period. So once what they called the safety bicycle at that time looks most closely like what we associate with a bicycle today, when that bicycle was invented, it became accessible for all kinds of people to ride. It didn't require this flying leap to get on the bicycle, basically. And so that really revolutionized how much people could ride around, and bicycles were affordable and automobiles were not. And so people were, you know, they would go joyriding basically out, you know, out in the countryside and stay over at hotels and inns and other things like that. And the quality of the roads was really terrible. They would be very muddy, or they were paved with logs, which were really bumpy, or cobbles, or, you know, they just, like, there wasn't great pavement technique yet. And macadam roads were still early in development. So the bicyclists started advocating for improved roads to improve the experience of getting out. And they used this economic argument, you know,
like the government.
Yeah. As part of their advocacy efforts and lobbying efforts.
Wow. So like,
you know, if it's easier for us to get out, you know, it's easier for us to spend money in these places. So
interesting, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, I take roads for granted. They're paved or they're not, right? But it's so interesting, right? To think that, well, we didn't have cars then. So what did they have? Well, right. I guess horses. We had the horses.
Uh-huh. And then early cars also were not very strong, robust, right? So in 1922, the first scenic highway in America was designed in Oregon along the Columbia River. And that opened in 1926. And one of the things about the Columbia River Gorge, excuse me, is that it's really cliffy, and the vehicles needed a much shallower grade than like to get up it. Otherwise, you know, what are you going to do? Get out of your car and push it up these steep hills. So they developed an engineering style and technique that kept the road grades below 5% so that the vehicles could make it up the steeper sections. And in order to do that, they put a lot of loops basically into the system to get the length that they needed to minimize the grade. And this was good also for railroads and other things like that. But as a bicyclist, it is so nice to ride on a historic road because it's not so steep, right? If the grade is 5%.
That's why there's this, like, you call, I don't know if you call them switchbacks, but I never thought of why they would do that, but that's for the grade. You have to. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have a side of a mountain, you have to go back and forth, right?
Right. Interesting. And the interstate system, you know, was designed actually so that you could land an airplane on it. So it couldn't, the freeways, that's part of why they were so wide and so straight. So you could land an airplane on it. They were developed as like a wartime something or other. Emergency. So
that is wild. That's really wild. I guess that's what you studied, right? That's why you know all this.
Yeah. Sorry to geek out about
No. It's I think it's interesting because it's like, I don't think about this stuff. So no, it's really cool. Obviously you were a good student because you learned all this, but all right. So we have like 13 minutes we have like 10 minutes before we have to wrap up. So let's talk about, so you obviously learned this. You were going to Washington to speak. You decided to ride your bike from Oregon to Washington. I loved hearing about it because I mean, just like sleeping outside with bugs is enough to make me not want to do it. Like how, you know, did you have your route planned? Did you know where you were going at all times or did you kind of wing it?
I knew how I was going. So there's an organization based in Missoula, Montana called Adventure Cycling Association. And they were established in 1976. They put together the route that I rode. They called it Bike Centennial at the time, but it's the Transamerica Bicycle Trail. And they inaugurated this route in 1976 as a way to celebrate the U.S. bicentennial. And so the route extends from Yorktown, Virginia to Florence, Oregon, or Astoria, Oregon. It goes coast to coast. And one of the nice things that the organization does as part of their route planning is they have already mapped out the lower traffic roads and connected them. And then on these maps, they have indicated the towns, the populations, and the kinds of services that you can get in them. And then the maps are in like 25-mile segments. So they make it really easy to plan out a route. Finishing school, I didn't have time to figure out how the heck I was going to go anywhere. So yeah. I actually established a partnership with Adventure Cycling Association to hand out window decals to the businesses along the route. So that gave me an opportunity to talk to the businesses about the benefit of bicyclists. I was kind of like a bike tourist ambassador, if you will, when I was out there. And in exchange, they gave me a jersey that was the U.S. bicycle route system. And they gave me these maps so that I could navigate my way across the country. So it was planned out in that respect, a daily basis, I was kind of winging it in terms of where I was going to stay.
Wow. So is that why you saw so many, it seems like you saw so many cyclists and some of the same over and over because they were following the same route?
That's correct.
That's so cool. Yeah. See, I didn't get all that. I was, you know, it's interesting what you focus on. Like I focus on the story, on the people, on the food, where's she going to eat? You know, is she going to the bathroom? Like all that stuff and that. Like I remember the decals, but I didn't really get why. So, okay, that's cool. Right. So I know you did make friends with some of the people and you had some amazing adventures, which you'll have to read the book to find out what they are. Interesting. Okay. And now can I just ask, were you like terrified? Like there would be times when I was reading it that I was like, like, were you scared at certain points?
I definitely was scared at certain points. Two moments come to me. So the first moment, this was about a little more than a week into the journey, and I was in Idaho, and I'd stopped in this very tiny town, and I was headed from a bar in the town where I had dinner to the RV park that was a little bit outside of town where I was going to camp for the night. And when I was riding on that road, there was no cars on it. It was totally empty. And somebody was coming up from behind me, just one vehicle, you know, pull over. I didn't stop, but I'm pedaling as far to the edge of the road as I could. And the road dropped off rather precipitously on the side. And, I look behind me, the car's coming. And then I noticed that this pickup truck starts to like veer into me as it's passing. So that terrified me, actually. I was like, there's no reason. I mean, apart from the fact that maybe they dropped their phone or something and they were looking for it, but there's no reason for this person to be swerving into me. It felt very, very aggressive. I felt very vulnerable. I was totally freaked out because there was nowhere I could go. It's like I could fall off the road or I could get hit on the road. Mm. So that was a moment certainly where I was very rattled. And
did you ever see that person again? I forget.
No, I did not.
No, you didn't. Okay.
Yeah. So
you never knew.
You know, there were other drivers can be very erratic. I mean, sometimes I was like, I wasn't so worried about the bears and the cougars. Yeah, I saw warning signs all over the place about bears and cougars, but drivers could be very erratic. There's a difference between a close call and an actual collision. And I never had a collision with anybody, but you know, there were some things that it's just part of the experience of being a bicyclist on the road is having kind of close calls. But that was one that really scared me. And then I did have some wildlife interactions that terrified me. One was, so, you know, I'd seen all these signs about how to protect yourself from bear and cougar attack. And I ended up in this place where there was a lot of haying activity going, but it was beautiful, beautiful.
A lot of what activity?
Haying. They were making hay.
Oh,
and wow. It's a beautiful meadow, mountains in the distance, wildflowers. And I had stopped to take a picture, and I was like, having these little pinches on my backside. And I looked down and I'm like covered in mosquitoes, absolutely covered in mosquitoes. So they flood the fields for the hay, and it's like mosquitoes everywhere. And so I was totally freaked out in this. There's like no way to get away from the mosquitoes except to like pedal as fast as I possibly can. And then a little.
Did they get off of you eventually?
Eventually. I mean, I had to kind of brush them off. I had to keep moving. And so I was.
Were you all bitten up?
I was, yes. Oh. I was hugely bitten up on my backside. It was very uncomfortable. And so I did have a tarp shelter. I didn't have a tent, but I had this tarp shelter, so it wasn't enclosed or anything. And I had been planning that night to camp, but I was like, there's no way in hell that I'm camping out in this place. You know, get me somewhere with a room that has screens on the windows. And so I had to ride further than I was planning to go to get to this, you know, an indoor lodging place. And on my way there, I saw something like fall out of the sky. And I was not sure what it was. I was like, was that just like some weird thing on my, on my sunglasses? Like, what was that? And then a giant hawk raptor, like flew at my head. And I was, anyway, read about this in the book, but I had this encounter with a raptor, and there was nothing anywhere that gave me any, like, no PSA about how to deal with the fact that, you know, a bird the size of half your body is like flying at your head.
So, wow.
Those were times I was terrified.
Yeah. Wow. But you kept going. I mean, that's amazing. You just kept going. So amazing. Woo. Woo. Okay. So we're going to wrap. We're going to start wrapping up. Show them your book again. We would love for you to support Heidi and her. Now, you're still for the scenic roads and all that and bicycling tourism and stuff like that. Are you still working with that? Is it going to support that or just, I know it's a great story. It's amazing what she went through, but what would you hope to accomplish with the book? And I guess, you know, I guess we are wrapping up now. You know, like 5 years from now, what would be your dream that would happen from the interview and from the book? What would be your dream?
Well, my hope for readers is just this acknowledgement that if you are feeling stuck in your life, that it is possible to get unstuck. And, you know, this is my story of how I did it. And I think it's possible for other people to take principles from this, but mostly I want people to take hope from it and kind of make the journey your own, that, you know, there are other things out there. If you feel the tug that there's something different for you in your life, that listen to that call, feel that tug and respond to it. And there were several people that I encountered along the ride who were feeling stuck in their lives. And I talked to them, and I think that, you know, it was a powerful moment for me to interact with them and think about, oh, here I am out transforming my life. Maybe they could take some inspiration from me while I was out there. They're doing it. And I feel like those people's experiences are are there for readers also. So in terms of historic roads, I feel like what I studied, what I learned, and the work that I did after this has really morphed into this idea of slow travel, where I'm really advocating now for people to take these three principles of slow travel and again make it their own. And like we were talking about at the beginning, I feel like these three principles make slow travel accessible to anybody, no matter their ability or orientation or, there's whatever the barriers are to other kinds of travel. I feel like there's something you can find in slow travel that you can take and embrace. Like I said, like the simplest thing is just go outside and pay attention to the weather. And part of the change and transformation that slow travel can affect in people's lives is by, you know, making an incremental change that you repeat over and over that then leads to a greater transformation over time. So, you know, it may not seem like much, but, you know, regularly practicing being in contact with, you know, the greater world around you, I feel like is one of the ways that I have come to feel less alone in the world, that I realize I'm part of the fabric of life and I'm not actually alone. And part of being out on my bike and encountering all these strangers and being cared for in ways I was not expecting really helped me come to see that even though I felt alone, I was not actually alone. Like it kind of took the glasses off or removed the varnish from how I was seeing the world, instead of seeing it as I am alone to, I am in community with other people, with other beings. And that was very, I don't know. It was so important for me to understand and recognize that, that I'm a part of everything. In the same way that, you know, encountering roadkill on a regular basis reminded me that I could be roadkill at any moment. And how am I showing up in this moment? It was so important for me to understand and recognize that, that I'm a part of everything. In the same way that, you know, encountering roadkill on a regular basis reminded me that I could be roadkill at any moment. And how am I showing up in this moment? It was so important for me to understand and recognize that.
Slow travel, it's such an interesting topic, and the scenic byways and all of that. So thank you for bringing that to people's attention. And thank you for being courageous and just doing what you did and conquering all of it. And again, read Heidi's book. Can you just hold it up one more time? Yes. Heidi Across America. It's such a cool book. If you have any interest in cycling, historic roads, any of that stuff, just get it. It's so cool. So thank you again. And thanks for being here. And we'll see y'all next week.
Bye. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.